I'm Em Sutter, better known as Pints and Panels.
And I'm Don Tess, better known as the Dawn of Beer.
Welcome to episode 44 of the All About Beer podcast. Every 2 weeks, we talk with leading experts and take a deep dive into one topic in beer. This week on the show, we're going to be talking about hop farming. Visit allaboutbeer.com and follow us on social media at All About Beer. And if you're feeling generous, visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/allaboutbeer, to support this show and others. Don, hop season is approaching here in North America, but yes. We're also going to be talking with a Southern Hemisphere hop farmer to talk about what they're doing now that harvest is over. I'm really excited to get this kind of dual prong approach about how the world is all one.
Yes.
Yet in the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere, we're kind of on the opposites. I'm excited.
Yeah, so am I. I think it's going to be neat to hear what happened and what's going to happen south and north of the equator, respectively.
Absolutely. And we have two really cool hop farmers that we're going to talk to about this. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
So if you'd like to help support the All About Beer podcast, reach out to podcast@allaboutbeer.com.
Estrella Galicia, where brewing excellence has been a family tradition since 1906. They're all about lager, rooted in the German brewing heritage. Maintaining their commitment to tradition, they brew exclusively in their original brewery in La Coruña, Spain. Each beer boasts its own distinctive recipe. No shortcuts, no compromises. They shun high-gravity tricks and avoid additives, even in their alcohol-free beers, and stick firmly to traditional methods. Their passion for beer sets them apart as they embrace and celebrate the art of brewing. At Estrella Galicia, they love beer above all things. Experience the difference and learn more on Instagram at Estrella Galicia, USA.
Eric Demaray, along with his wife Shelley, are co-owners of CLS Farms in Yakima, Washington. He is a fourth-generation hop farmer, having worked on the farm since he graduated from Washington State University with a degree in agricultural economics. Eric's love for farming is deeply rooted in the multi-generational influence of his family. CLS Farms' progressive, forward-looking approach focuses not only on providing brewers with the highest quality hops, but also with the most current up-to-date market information. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good, good. Thanks for taking time out of your farming schedule to chat with us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. Always good to connect with everybody out there and kind of let everybody know what's cooking for the season here. So
it's April. What does the farm situation look like right now? What's on the docket for today? What are you planning? What normally are you doing around this time to get prepared for the season?
Yeah, I mean, April and May and up to about mid-June are really busy periods for hop growers. I would rank it up there actually similar to harvest. Definitely this is a busy period. We have to be really timely with how we do a few different things on the farm right now. So that always puts some pressure on us. Typically, right, I mean, today I would say almost every hop farm in the United States is twining, absolutely tying the twine at the top and clipping it at the bottom. So if you drove around Moxie this morning, you'd probably see 7, 8, 9 different twining crews going. And then, so that's about a 4 to 5 week process for most growers. And that needs to be done timely. You really need to be done kind of mid-May or so. That would be roughly the timeline. And so there can be weather challenges with that. When the wind blows, it blows the strings and it becomes difficult for them to tie. And so definitely, windy days will stop them. So you're kind of tracking that front every day. And then I think the other big one here is to, we have to adjust how the plants grow. That's a kind of a strange way to say it, but
yeah, that sounds weird to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not quite as, draconian as maybe that sounds, but the first growth that comes out of the ground, the first growth that comes out of the ground is too early, and it's not the quality of growth that we want. And so hops are day length sensitive. And if we kind of trained and let the first growth come out, they would get goofed up on their day length and it'd be too early. So there's a variety of mechanisms we do to, quote, set them back. And so some varieties we need to set back twice, other varieties one time, and it's a fairly complicated matrix across all the varieties. And so some varieties are train dates are really important to be in this window, and some varieties train dates are really important to be in that window. So there's a lot of gaming going on right now out in the fields to get those adjustments done and the way each individual farm would like them. And obviously we're growers, you know, and so all hop growers think they do it better than the other hop growers. So there's no pre-specified timeline here. Everybody has their own thoughts and theories on it. Typically that takes the form of you can mechanically set them back, like with a mower. We have these large mowers that actually just mow the first growth off. So a lot of growers are mowing. There's also a herbicide action, which we call a burn back. And a burn back is a herbicide that all it does is just flash burn the vegetation. It doesn't kill the plant or anything like that. It just any vegetation above the ground, it burns it back chemically back to the ground. And then, and so that's an effective way. So usually most farms are some form of chemical burn back and also mowing or a mechanical means to get there. So that's top of mind for most growers, those twining and adjusting the setback dates for each variety.
What variety is the, like, cause you mentioned one, sometimes they have to do it twice. What variety is like the real big pain in the ass? Is there one that you're like, oh man, not you again?
Yeah. There are, I would say, Centennial is the most finicky one.
Okay.
Timing wise. It doesn't like to be set back multiple times, but it also doesn't like to be trained too early. So that one is finicky. But the ones that definitely are aggressive and we have to kind of keep beating them back would be Mosaic, Chinook, CTZ. Those types of varieties are super aggressive and you just keep knocking them back and they just keep coming back and knocking them back and they just keep coming back.
I'm just trying to think of, I guess, genetically or agriculturally, why this would be necessary. Is it that you're trying to create almost a harsh environment for the hops so that they flower more?
Not necessarily. So the most of the reason is hops are day length sensitive. Okay. And so if they get what we call so many nodes, and if you look on a hop vine, a node is where a leaf pair comes out. And so if you look at a hop vine, you'll see these leaf pairs that come out. I forget the number, and it varies a little bit from variety, but if you get something like, you know, 15 leaf pairs, if the vine gets 15 leaf pairs or 17 leaf pairs, like I said, I can't remember the exact number, but if it gets so high before the longest day of the year, which is like June, say 18th, yeah. if you get too much height before, the summer, I guess you'd call it summer equinox or, then it triggers the plant to go into reproductive mode. And once the plant goes into reproductive mode, it stops, basically pretty much stops growing vertically.
Oh, I see.
Yes. So you get short, stunted, non-filled in plants if you go too early. Now, other varieties, and so each variety has certain, there's certain sensitivities to that. Across the variety chain. So it's not necessarily to give it a harsh environment. It's to set it back so it doesn't start growing vertically later. You want it to start growing vertically mid-May, not mid-April. So
I see. I understand.
You'd be too tall. You'd be way too tall before the longest day of the year.
This is not a concept I understand, being too tall. But
me either.
I wanted to ask, you kind of talked about what you're doing now. How much of, the cutting it back and all that, how much of what you're doing and what you're planning is affected by what has already happened? And I'm thinking specifically the weather, the snow, how much snow you've had and how that affects your irrigation going forward, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So as you can imagine, I mean, just real quickly to touch on weather and how it relates to these setback days. If you have warmer than average weather, let's say in March and April, the plants are giving you a lot of early growth,
right,
and a lot more grief. And typically what we like to say is the longer the plants stay asleep, the better. And because they're burning resources right now growing, if it's warm, they're burning their carbohydrates that they've stored up over the winter. And so typically what we like to see is the plants to stay what we call, like I said, asleep longer. Now we've had an El Nino winter here in the Pacific Northwest, which means a little bit warmer and a little bit drier than normal. And that's about how it's played out. And so kind of how weather's affecting us now is the plants are definitely more advanced right now than we've seen, we've seen this many times, but a little more advanced than average, not horribly, but a little more. So that's creating some little bit of issues on trying to make sure we can get in there and set them back the right way. But as far as El Nino's impact on our water supply, it looked very, very, our water supply is dictated by two things: carryover water levels in the reservoirs that feed our irrigation system, and then also that year's rain and snowpack. And it was looking pretty dire last October, I would say. And I think what made everybody nervous was this definitely was an El Nino year, which can be much drier and much warmer than average. But this El Nino fizzled a little bit. And while it is it has been somewhat drier and somewhat warmer, not dramatically so. So right now we're looking at about the water supplies are complicated, and that could be a 4-hour podcast in itself. But for what the short and quick of it is it's about a 60% supply on water, and that's manageable. That's okay. Manageable for most growers. Yeah.
Okay.
So it was looking rough, but it's going to be fine and be in a man. It's going to take a little bit extra money and a little hustle and a little of this and a little of that, but 60% we can work through pretty decently. So,
okay. Awesome. Thank you.
So how do you deal with trends since you're growing now and you have acreage of lots of different varieties, I'm assuming, how do you plan on what you grow because you've got to plant things so far in advance? What's that like? Because that's got to be, I'm thinking as a casual drinker, that's got to be like stressful because you got to make sure everything that you're growing what people want. But then maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah, no, that's you've done a very important topic, and so one thing. This term certainly I didn't come up with, but it's been used pretty extensively. Craft beer drinkers in general are fairly promiscuous in their choices, right? And I think they actually track that. I don't know if it's actually increased or decreased, but the promiscuity of the craft beer drinker is still strong, I think. And so yes, it becomes very challenging at the grower level for us to understand where to go. And so especially becomes even more difficult in times of oversupply and inventory excesses, which we have in the industry right now. And so at the grower level, a lot of I think it's important for people to understand that the vast majority of hops go through a broker or a middleman, such as Yakima Chief or Haws, or, you know, lots of different ones out there. Those are the two largest. But, and so, you know, we really respond to what they come to us and ask us to grow. And so there has been a lot more communication between grower and brewers than there ever was in the past, and that helps. But at the end of the day, what we need at the grower level is someone saying, we want to buy your hops. That's the only thing that we really have to rely on. There are a few farms sell directly to brewers. So that chain, you understand that really well. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the vast majority of hops that growers, they sell to a middle person and then up to the brewer. And so we rely on that middle person to guide us.
Yeah. And so your hops have already essentially been spoken for then.
In many cases. And so, they're one dealer could be, let's say, Long Centennial, and another dealer could be Short Centennial. So maybe there isn't any actual increased Centennial demand out there, but mm-hmm. dealer X needs to buy Centennial. So they come into the market and buy some. That doesn't necessarily mean that there is increased Centennial demand. It just means that particular dealer,
yeah.
the brewers they sell to, needed Centennial for the moment. So
I just want to interject that I love Centennial. Oh, okay.
It's a good hub. It's a real workhorse.
Yes,
it is.
But then I guess on the other side, is there like any time where there's oversupply on your end, or are all your hops, you know, like meant for it, you know, meant for a space, or does that not happen?
Yeah, no, the hop industry has always been in a cycle, and so that cycle's driven by a couple of factors, and just kind of real simply, the cycle is driven by kind of two things I like to say. One is you can't make beer without hops, right? Okay. And so it's a little bit like oxygen. And, you know, if you as a person thought you were going to run out of oxygen, you might contract, or you thought the threat of running out of oxygen was there, you might contract for a little bit more than what you think, right? Mm-hmm. Or you might contract with the oxygen supplier. You might think, okay, I'm going to have a few more kids in my family, so I need some more oxygen. And so you might say, okay, and I'm nervous because I can't live without oxygen, so I'm going to buy some extra. I think I'm going to have a few more kids, so I'm going to buy more oxygen, right? That's a very rational decision. And that's the same with brewing. You can't, you know, the fun bust of brewing is over if you don't have the hops. And so when hops get short, it drives that kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side is, though, for all intents and purposes, there's nothing to do with hops when there's too many. And they store well. We put them in pellets, we put them in nitrogen flushed, oxygen free foil bags, and they go into cold storage. And so when you get into times of excess, it's very problematic because there's nowhere to sell them to, like to cow feed or something like that, or some other thing. And they don't really spoil. I mean, they do after about three, four, 5 years, they're not as good, high quality 3-year-old hops processed and stored well, the average brewer, many brewers aren't even going to be able to tell the difference. And mm-hmm. so when there's excess, that creates all kinds of problems. And so we're currently, you know, so a lot of people want to assign blame in the industry, and you'll hear this and you'll read this, and they want to assign blame, but those two factors are what drive it the most. And so we swing between oversupplies and undersupplies, and we're currently in an oversupply. And so if you think about it, you have that inventory. What's the only way to get that inventory to move in to the system? Or, you know, and most of this inventory is being held by brewers, right? Not even by growers or dealers. Brewers are long. And so the only way for that inventory to get used is for there to be cuts in acreage that are actually below the background demand level, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because if you don't grow as much as the brewing industry demands, then it forces the inventory to come into the system.
Right.
And
or everybody should start drinking hot water.
Oh, yeah. Or hot water. Or a new demand source. Hey, trust me, new demand source, that solves it too. And so then what happens is the acreage base comes down below the background latent demand level, right? And then when the inventories go away, boom, you got a shortage.
Right.
And now there's not enough acres. And then there's the panic, the no oxygen moment kicks in, and there we go right back up. So, you know, so like I said, a lot of people want to ascribe motives and, you know, big conspiracy theories up and down and left and right. And this person did that, and that dealer did that, and this grower did that, and this brewer did that, whatever. But at the end of the day, it's those two basic economic facts that drive that cycle. So that's kind of where we sit today.
Okay. You know, you kind of mentioned how craft beer drinkers tend to be a bit promiscuous. And I think a lot of people like to order the latest hazy IPA based on, you know, oh, I love Mosaic or Citra or whatever. So that's great. People are familiar with the flavors that hops produce. But what do you wish the average beer drinker understood about what you do?
That's a tough one because, you know, I think, you know, we exist for the beer drinker. We don't exist for the hop dealer. We don't exist for the brewer. We exist for the beer drinker out there. And I think if beer drinkers want to be promiscuous, the rest of us in the hop supply chain, we got to figure out how to handle that. But here's what I would say, the promiscuity, what it does cause when you kind of move back down the hop supply chain, is it drives more changeouts in varieties. And hops are perennials, and we can't just plant a new variety the next year. It's very expensive to take out the other variety, the old variety, and plant the new variety. And then we only get maybe 50, 60% of a yield the first year. And then the second year, we're back up to 100%. And so it's really a 2-year, you know, process, and it's expensive. And we're more than willing to do it, but it does create challenges on the supply chain side of it, in all levels. And so that's just something we have to figure out, but it definitely as hop growers, I'm old enough to know the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. This is before craft, and we never switched varieties. I mean, very rarely would you see this. And now, yeah, every year in the hop growing area, we see 15, 10, 15, 20% turnover acreage wise. Oh, wow. Yeah, on the farms. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we've kind of taken it as a baseline that about 10% of our farm probably needs to be flipped and turned over to other varieties every year. And if we can keep it to that, that's a dull roar, and that kind of keeps it. I mean, it does increase hop costs, no doubt, but I don't know if the average consumer will notice those increased hop costs. But at the end of the day, those increased hop costs do have to translate into higher beer prices. But I don't think it's not a dramatic cost. And
right.
what the market is telling us is brewers or consumers are willing to pay a little bit more to have that promiscuity. So,
great. Awesome. Thank you.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us today. If people want to reach out to you or learn more about your farm, do you have a website or social media handles you can share?
Yeah, sure. Our website is clsfarms.com, and some good information on there. And then on social media, we're on Facebook and Instagram and all that. Instagram would be our one that is probably we update and post on quite a bit, and that we track the whole growing season. So there's twining videos on there. There's,
oh, cool. You know,
yeah. And the twining videos, that is the most popular. Every time we post that, everybody just loves to look at that. So that's on, I know that's on there right now. I'm not sure exactly how the hashtags and all that stuff work, but if you type in CLS Farms on Instagram, I'm sure you're going to find us. So
great. Well, thank awesome. You so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was super great. Love talking to you guys.
Thank you, Eric.
Awesome. Yeah, cheers.
Cheers.
Yep.
And we'll be right back with Andrew Sutherland, farm manager of Osthaus Hops, right after these messages.
At Estrella Galicia, thanks to their strong ties and inspiration from the German brewing tradition, their very first brew came to life, a German Pilsner. Initially, it was only available in La Coruña and could be enjoyed at their own beer garden. But by the 1920s, when their master brewer joined the team, they expanded their range to include a Munich, a Bock, and a Doppelbock. The selection and care of the yeast were essential to ensure the success of the fermentation, and they made the big decision to preserve their own yeast strain. Experience the difference and learn more on Instagram at Estrella Galicia USA.
Andrew Sutherland caught the hop bug in 2014 after taking up the farm manager's job at Osthaus Farms after working 15 years in the New Zealand viticulture industry. Fast forward 10 years and he hasn't looked back. The passion for working with the plant, the people, and the soil still gets him out of bed with a strong motivation to continue to improve on the previous year's result. Nelson Sauvin is a mainstay of Osthaus Farms, with half the farm planted in that variety, which performs well on the soils of the Motier Valley subregion of Nelson, as well as smaller areas of traditional varieties like Green Bullet and Wakatu. Osthaus also grows Motueka, Nectaron, and the conundrum that is Rewaka. Andrew is the current chair of the NZ Hops Growers Committee, which serves as the conduit between the supplier growers and the quality team at NZ Hops, working on continuous improvement to hop quality by setting quality standards for hops delivered to the co-op. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hi, Em. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. Thank you for, it's 7 a.m. where you are right now, so thank you for being up and about while we chat with you, because you are tucked all the way down there.
It's a beautiful time of day.
I've never been in New Zealand, and it is on my, I've been to Australia, but that is not the same thing, and I would love to come down.
I always like to point out when we have our, you know, New Zealand, Australia guests on, that you are speaking to us from tomorrow, so you're from the future, and
I think that's very cool.
Appreciate, yeah. Let us,
we appreciate you traveling back in time with us. So yes. Anyway, what are you currently doing right now at the farm? The harvest is over. So for our listeners, like I'm assuming farming always keeps going. So what are you currently working? Do you get to have a well-deserved break, or are you constantly doing stuff? What are you doing at the moment farming?
I guess I live on the farm, so one of my dilemmas is that there's always stuff outside the window you can see to do. But one of the important things in the cycle is to take a break and refresh. So I'm just about to head away for a trip around the North Island of New Zealand with my two sons. So clear my head post harvest for 2 weeks and come back with some refreshed focus and enthusiasm. But we finished harvest exceptionally early this year, but we cropped a little less area in response to the apparent market demand. So we finished around the 18th of March, which is the earliest we've ever done on farm. So we're reasonably advanced in our kind of autumn to-do list. We've wrapped up the maintenance in the kiln and the picker shed, involving cleaning all of the debris of harvest out, and we've turned our minds out back into the garden. So you know, the to-do list, we've been busy spreading the compost from last year's green waste onto fields that need a little bit of extra organic matter and energy. We're beginning the work of structure maintenance, so we're out retensioning the wires that we string to or twine to, and of course the cross cables that hold those up. And sowing a few autumn cover crops. We're toying with a little bit of regenerative horticulture here. So we're starting to increase the priority of doing things like composting and growing green cover crops to improve soil.
Oh, interesting. How did harvest go this year? Was it successful? Did anything not go to plan? Should everybody be heavily future contracting to lock in, or yes. Is everything a-okay?
Contract now. No.
Okay.
Look, I think in New Zealand, we've heard the message about the kind of inventory that's in the system, and that we needed to respond to that. So growers have made their own judgments about how much of their farm to string this last year or to twine. And so for most people, potentially, they weren't cropping their whole area that they had potential to do. So many of us had a slightly shorter harvest. I guess, you know, these are trying times for farmers in terms of being faced with that proposition of not drawing income from your whole property. But the silver linings or the benefits of that were our ability to move pretty quickly across the land, get to each variety in, I think, the ideal harvest window. We weren't under logistics pressure, so we could wait for the maturity, watch that come into the sweet spot, and then go out and grab those hops in optimum condition. So you know, it appears getting feedback from New Zealand hops who we supply that, you know, they've seen really nice colour this year. For their feedback to suppliers, they've really upgraded their sensory analysis of each batch of hops that arrives at the co-op, and we get that back within a day or so of having picked and dried and sent the hops to the co-op. So some pretty positive quality sensory descriptors coming through, and in the blocks that we did yield, pretty pleasing yields as well. And that was in a summer, this summer, for the records on this farm, or our neighbours who've been around longer than us, has been the driest summer in 50 years. So it's probably the standout feature of this harvest is we began the season with pretty nice ground moisture. We had plentiful rain through the winter period, but really it didn't rain again in any material way until about 4 days ago, when we had around about 4 inches or 100 mil of rain to revive the ground and let it breathe. So you know, the dry was something that's uncommon for us for that extended period of time. It meant we had to be pretty attentive to soil moisture and our irrigation. On this farm, we irrigate from a dam, so we had a limited volume of water that had to make it all the way through the season. And fortunately, we did that successfully and secured the crop in what I believe is really, really good condition. Reaching back to my days working in the wine industry, New Zealand wine often talked about the current harvest or vintage being better than the previous. I think potentially it's not glib to say maybe we've turned out a really good crop with really great intense flavors from this summer. I think you know, we didn't have to deal with problems related to wet weather. We're fortunate in New Zealand not to have wet weather disease. So the plants look pretty beautiful and healthy. The cones was stunning. So yeah, potentially it could be a really great quality season.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Delicious.
Yes, I'm looking forward to. Please, brewers working with these hops, vintage date your beer so that we know that they're this year's New Zealand hops. To the contrary, I'm hearing that climate change is quite dramatically affecting European hops. Like I'm hearing some of them are having alpha acid, of 1% instead of the typical, 9, 10%. So is climate change affecting hops in New Zealand yet? Is this a concern? And what can we be doing about it? Well, maybe though what we can do about it is maybe too loaded of a question, but is it a concern?
Well, how long's the podcast, Assault Sick? Look, the stats I have back for sort of average alpha acids across varieties for this harvest would indicate that they haven't been dramatically affected. We may be a few percentage points up on some varieties and a few percentage points down on others. So, yeah, I don't think there's an obvious trend emerging there. I perhaps, if we're going to have less rainfall, we're going to have to be more expert at managing soil moisture. But I guess, some of the benefits of that is if we haven't got such a vigorous plant because we haven't had extra rainfall, we may have a more open hop canopy and better sunlight penetration into the canopy. So all hops on any given plant may be receiving the same heat and light, which may, give a very even ripeness. And so when we're out sampling, rubbing the hops and checking for when to pick them, any given hop that we're picking on a plant that has a more open structure with that kind of sunlight penetration will point to, the exact ripeness that we have in the field, so that when we pick it, the whole field comes in at a consistent ripeness. So there could be benefits to it as well as challenges.
It's interesting.
Yeah, very.
What percentage of the plants did you up and replant? So, like things you take out and put in. I know it takes years to get a good crop for new plants. So, how do you plan, with the rise of new stuff like Nectaron or the love affair that us Americans have with Ruwaka? How do you plan for that?
I guess we work very closely with NZ Hops. We supply them. They provide us with indications around market demand for each variety. I've been farming on this farm for 10 years. We started out with a very large proportion of the farm in an older variety called Wakatoo. Not such a strong aroma hop, and gradually over that time we've transitioned as we can best understand the market demand. So we grow quite a significant amount of Nelson Sauvin because it was, it still is, I think, New Zealand's number one hop variety by volume. And then once we sort of hit a ceiling for our ability to harvest that in the ideal window, we're working with Nectaron and Rewalker. Sometimes it's well-founded spreadsheeting and science and market feedback, and sometimes it's a judicious guess about how far we go and how many hectares we plant. Particularly with the rate the industry's been changing, if you rush into something, potentially you overshoot what the market's ready for. So a little bit boring, but we try to progress in sensible steps rather than going wholesale and find that we've completely oversupplied the market.
Yeah, sure. And then what's the plan for next year? Is there any new exciting varieties, or do you get to plan experimental stuff? Anything that we here in North America should be like, ooh, should we be getting excited about that? Maybe that you can talk or not talk about it. I don't know what the secrecy of New Zealand hops are, but
So I guess the obviously Nectaron was launched a couple of years ago when we're growing that. It's still we were one of the initial try growers of that pre commercial release. So the beginning of the process for trial varieties is to plant about a half a hectare. Very early on, and that's going into the BRACT brewing program. You know, I guess people are understanding Nectar on pretty well now in terms of having made beers and understood how it works for them. Again, this season, because of the climatic conditions, it's looking amazing. The next exciting prospect for us is Superdelic, which is now in the market. We haven't actually got any of that on the farm, but again, a reasonable volume has been growing this year. It's probably, in the bigger scheme of things, still a fairly small volume out in world volumes, but very exciting feedback from brewers who've been to visit during harvest and smell Superdelic. So we're excited to get some of that in the ground here at Oasthaus. And then looking ahead, there are new varieties that are coming through pre-release, probably a couple that I understand are about ready to go into that half hectare trial lot in a variety of farms around the district. So we'll be putting our hands up to see some of those new varieties, and their first appearance out to brewers would be through the NZ Hop Bracked Brewer Program. So yeah, that's, you know, one of the really exciting things in the New Zealand hop industry is that Ron Beetson's legacy has been that there's a very valuable portfolio of breeding material at Plant and Food, which is the organisation that does our breeding, and they're continuing to bring through new varieties that show huge value in the future. So yeah, we'll be putting our hands up to do that. And you know, just to expand on that program a little bit, you only, as a supplier to New Zealand Hops, you have to get in the queue to be able to grow those varieties, and there's a fairly rigorous program around your track record of quality of your hops to be at the front of the queue for being the early growers with those trial varieties. So it's a really nice program of protecting the quality of those trial varieties as they come through to commercialization, and make sure that we're really showing the full potential of the new varieties.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's exciting.
Yeah. This might be a stupid question, but in North America, a lot of the experimental hop varieties, they get a numbered name like HBC 472 or whatever. Is there a similar naming convention in New Zealand?
There is. I believe we're sort of a little bit cautious to talk about those things in the wild before, when they're in pre-release. So,
okay.
yeah, you know, I guess we talk about that a little bit internally. And in the early days, you know, we've come through to the naming nomenclature being after regions of the Nelson area, where we've had things like Wakatu, and Rewalker is a small village within the area. Now, perhaps we're taking on a little more sophistication with namings like Nectaron and Superdelic.
Okay, I was just trying to be cute to see if there was anything beer lovers should be looking for, but we'll let you keep your secrets.
We can wait. Patience, Ron. patience, Don. Come on.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be too tricky, but I guess, I don't know, smarter people than me in intellectual property perhaps sound a little bit of caution about talking about those things too soon. So I just follow their advice.
Okay. What is something you wish the casual beer drinker knew about what you do as a hop grower? To appreciate what you're doing, I guess.
Yeah, I guess, you know, myself and I haven't really met a hop farmer yet that's not really passionate about the place they grow their hops in and the flavor that they're trying to go. You know, it's kind of a fun industry to be in, to talk about that you're growing flavor. So there's when we get together and share a beer and talk about hop growing, really, you know, it's the passion. We're looking increasingly at how we look after the soil in terms of supporting the plant to grow healthily, to resist environmental challenges naturally, be that excess rain or excess dry, or in New Zealand, the only thing that troubles our hops is two spotted mite. And if we've got a healthy soil and a healthy plant, there's more natural kind of resistance, which, you know, speaks to a better sustainability story. We ostensibly on this farm, we manage that two spotted mite threat with beneficial insects. So that sustainability story is something that's important to me and many of the other growers, you know, and to pursue that, we're now growing entirely on this farm with a biodegradable string. So when we cut the hops down and take the green waste to our compost pile, that's completely breaking down in the 12 months that we're composting. And we're working hard, you know, particularly after the summer we've just had with the amount of dryness, to scrutinize the amount of water we're using and find more efficient ways to grow with water and equally with fertilizer. So, you know, things as a grower in terms of continuously improving to grow a better aroma, better flavor, but also look after the place we live in and grow. So, yeah, you know, I think that's a pretty common passion amongst other hop growers, and certainly one that's very strong for me in this farm.
Awesome. Drink sustainably.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today. If people want to reach out to you or learn more about yourself or the farm, do you have a website or social media that you can share with us?
Yeah, probably the main social media for Oasthouse Hops is our Instagram page. We are on the New Zealand Hops website as well, but the easy and main place that we're posting pictures and telling our story is through Instagram, so we can link up to that.
Wonderful. Andrew, thank you so much for taking time out of your morning to speak with us, and enjoy your vacation. You deserve it.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew. Cheers.
Cheers.
So, Don, what did you think of today's program?
I loved it. You know, I think as a beer lover, I'm very conscious of the fact of you know, oils and acids and the flavor components. But it was really interesting to hear about, you know, it's an agricultural product. So hearing about the compost and, you know, cutting back the buying, because if it leaves too early, you know, these are things that I don't think about. So I think that's really cool.
I don't think anyone really thinks about it. I loved when Andrew said they grow flavor.
Yes.
That was such a, like, I was just like, oh, wow. That's a really, you know, I mean, you're growing something that I think of it as like, it's like a salad kind of. I mean, they used to use it for salad greens and like stomach aches and like helping you sleep and whatnot. Yeah. But it's such a unique product that goes into making beer, and it's an agricultural product. I think it's fascinating, and it's really cool to talk to these people that are on the front lines of new, and there's new things growing too, you know. It's not just gardening is changing and farming is changing. It's awesome.
Right. Yeah Very we cool. have to think about, like, even sunlight and things, like, you know, I don't know,
and rain just, and right? climate yeah. change, and, you know, how, where they are and what can grow there, and, you know, what it's
compostable,
be really,
twine.
Compostable twine. It'll be really interesting to, like, go back in 10 years and talk to them in the future and see how things are changed, because it's just everything. Beer is constantly evolving and changing, not just the styles, but the things that go into the beer as well. Yeah. I think it's
put it in your calendar. 10 years.
All right. 10 years from now, I'm sure we'll go to New Zealand. We'll have some space beers with, I don't know what's going to happen in 10 years. Visit the allaboutbeer.com website. That is our website. And follow us on social media at allaboutbeer. And again, if you're feeling generous, please visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/allaboutbeer, to support this show and others. And if you have any questions for the experts, email podcast@allaboutbeer.com. That's also the email for feedback, suggestions, or to inquire about supporting this show through advertising. Don, how can people reach out to you?
I am the Don of Beer on X, Threads, and Instagram, and people can drop me an email at don@thedawnofbeer.com, because I love nerding out on beer subjects. How about you, Em?
I am at Pints and Panels across all social media, and my website is pintsandpanels.com. Here is a final word from our sponsor.
Big breweries around the world have set up laboratories in their factories to isolate and preserve their yeast strains and monitor fermentation using scientific methods. Aware that healthy yeast ensures healthy fermentation and therefore good beer, brewers created yeast banks. In the various yeast banks located worldwide, each brewery stores its yeast under optimal conditions, as is the case with Estrella Galicia, which specifically stores its own lager yeast strain and the renowned Weinstephan Brewery in Germany. This ensures that, in the event of any issues at the brewery, they can always recover their yeast and not lose the unique character that defines their beers. This is especially important considering that each of their beers is brewed from a unique, distinctive, and differentiated wort. Experience the difference and learn more on Instagram at Estrella Galicia, USA.
This show is produced by All About Beer. Visit allaboutbeer.com for articles, notes on this show and others, and to connect via the newsletter and social media. Cheers.
Cheers.
Compostable twine.